As Larry announced, we try to have a session on Holden Alternatives at least once a week. And we're doing a number of things here at the village that in one way aren't that unique, but we're trying to do a few things that will be of an educational nature to the many people that come through the village, for one thing. I guess this, in a way, is one of our primary objectives. Secondly, we're trying to also cut down on the cost of the operation. As you either know or can imagine, the cost of operating the village is very expensive, and we face some of the same problems as everybody else, not only in the future but the present, of trying to keep going here at the village within a financial structure that's practical for people to come. So it's, in a way, it's really a very, I think, exciting and fun challenge that we have now in this day and age, not only here but for all of us, to try to make use of the materials, the fuel sources that are available to us, take it on as a challenge even in our own families, to find ways that in our individual homes that we can cut down on our fuel use or utilize waste products that would ordinarily cost us something to get rid of and then we not get anything out of them, to come up with methods that we can get some good use out of them and then save the cost to the city or ourselves in disposing of like solid wastes. And also, I'm sure for you all, you realize that because of our remote location here at the village, that we have all the functions of a city. We have our own sewage system, our own water system, garbage disposal, all of those things that maybe you normally wouldn't think too much about because you just pay your bill and somebody comes and collects it, or you flush your toilet and that's the last you think of it. Well, here it's not the last we think of it. We have to think of it for a little bit further. And so, in a sense, the village is a nice little micro community in many ways, not only from the sociological standpoint, but from the physical standpoint too. And a lot of the challenges that we have here can be transferred into your own home situation. So some of the things that we're trying to do, and I'll maybe just go down the list of them, and then we can concentrate on a few of them, or you can just ask questions and deal with those items that you're most interested in. But with our sewage system presently, we have a regular collector system. It goes down through the collector into a septic tank, 15,000-gallon septic tank. During the winter, we use a drain field. During the summer, we pump the effluent up to the tailings number one. There are two evaporating ponds on the tailings. Part of the sewage is disposed of just by evaporation. This is a standard method of sewage disposal in even a lot of large cities. Then we, because our lagoons really aren't large enough, we also are carrying on a small experiment on the rehabilitation of the tailings by use of irrigating a portion, about two and a half acres of tailings, with the effluent. And the Bureau of Mines about 5 years ago came in to do some experiments on getting vegetation to grow on the tailings, and their conclusion more or less was that it wasn't that difficult if you had the money, and that's always the problem. If you have enough money, you can do anything, just about. what they were really proposing was the use of lime to neutralize the acid. The tailings are very acidic from the nature of the rock, not so much the acids that they added to it, but it was a sulfide rock, and this being exposed to the atmosphere and moisture converts into sulfuric acid, and then this increases the acid content. Of course, it's also just plain ground rock, so that there's no organic or food content to the tailings, so that you have to add lime to neutralize the acid, you have to add fertilizer to provide something for the plants to grow in, and then, of course, water to get it started. And they were talking in terms of like 20 tons of lime per acre. And this is 80 acres up there, so you can imagine just the amount of money, and maybe even more so the amount of time that it would take to get that many tons of lime up here to just deal with the tailings. And of course, you'd also have to, again, irrigate it and fertilize it. Well, in our area where we've been irrigating out of our lagoons, we have a beautiful stand of grass. It's almost like a little garden growing up on one section of the tailings. So eventually, when the Forest Service gets enough money to begin the rehabilitation work, then we would put in a larger sewage system, larger lagoons, and a permanent irrigation system on tailings number one, so that I would estimate within 5 years from the time that we started that project that we would, tailings number one would all be nice and green with grasses, native grasses, and some that we would plant.
Golf course.
Yeah, we've talked about a golf course. In fact, we've got an 80-acre sand trap up there now, so that you can start playing on it if you'd like. And our garbage disposal, solid waste disposal, is somewhat the same thing, that it is a problem. We face, in fact, a very serious potential problem, even to the extent of maybe closing the village down at some point in the future, because all over the country, because of the pollution potential of landfills, of dumps, of various other forms of solid waste disposal, the government, county, and city are becoming much more tight on regulations. In Chelan County, there are only three authorized garbage disposal or solid waste landfill sites. We're at the 3.5 site. We're not really official, but they also recognize our unique situation, and also this is one place where the tailings have become a savior figure almost for us, and at the same time that they pollute the area, they also provide an excellent place for solid waste disposal and sewage disposal. So we both get benefits, and at the same time we have some difficulties with the tailings. What we're trying to do with both sewage disposal and solid waste is get some benefit from them, like the sewage disposal, sprinkle the tailings, start grass to grow. Solid waste disposal, if we can take our wet garbage and compost it, then we can get some usable organic matter for replenishing the topsoil, which is very thin in any mountain area. I think we have about 95% rock and 5% poor soil, so it's really not that easy. Even flower gardens, these gardens that we have around here have been supplemented over the years with compost, and we save our dirt. When we empty the flower pots at the end of the year, we don't just throw them away. We save it and reuse it because it's very hard to get. So the composting becomes one method of helping one problem of disposing of the wet garbage. On the other hand, it provides a solution to another problem of coming up with some organic matter. We have various methods that we've used for composting. One is just a standard compost box that we don't even turn or aerate. We use that in the wintertime. Second thing that we're trying now is, if you've been up to the lower mine level, you've maybe seen a big black barrel up there that is rotating very slowly. That's another method of composting that is aerobic or adds air. The idea of the rotating barrel would be just to aerate the garbage, and the bacteria that operates in the presence of oxygen works much more quickly and without as much odor as what you would get if you just leave a pile of garbage in a confined area without aerating it. That's why they recommend in maybe magazines that you've written to once a week or once a day to take a shovel and just rotate your compost. That's primarily or exclusively to get air into the system. And the barrel does the same thing, only a little bit more quickly and then without having to do it with a shovel. That's a 500-gallon barrel. If we wanted to dispose of all of our wet garbage by that method, we would probably have to build two or three more of the barrels, and then having a couple of barrels constantly working and a couple more that we'd be filling. But we're really not sure how it's going to work out, but it appears that maybe within 30 days we could have good composted wet garbage, whereas normally if we don't aerate it and turn it, it would take maybe a year, year and a half. Another thing that we're trying is the worms, the earthworms that everybody is familiar with, but maybe most of you don't realize that they're also good garbage eaters. And they also are probably the fastest way of rebuilding topsoil that we have in the world today. And probably in the next 10 years, you're going to be hearing more and more of another shortage that we're going to run into. Everything's in short supply. It either causes cancer or it's in short supply these days, one or the other. And but the topsoil is, we're losing topsoil in the world faster than we're building it. We're building it very slowly. And a lot of our present farming methods are creating problems along this line, and even new farming methods may have to be instituted. Corn, for one, is one crop that probably deteriorates topsoil faster than anything else. But all of the tillable crops tend to lose topsoil, and it's going to be one of the major concerns in the coming years. Well, earthworms are one possibility, and even we would need an awful lot of earthworms to replenish our topsoil, but they are one of the present makers of topsoil, and they do it very quietly. They don't disturb us at night, anything like that. They're very good workers. They go after their own food and are pretty good workers, really. And well, they don't. If you really go into it on a large scale basis, you do have to. You know, it could cover quite an area, but like in our situation here, we just have a box that's right next to the greenhouse, and you can go up there and look at it, but unfortunately you can't see anything because they also work underground and they don't like the light, so there's no way that we can, you'll just have to take our word for it that they're there. You can dig in it and see the earthworms if you'd like, that's no problem, but there's nothing you can really see. But commercially what they do, they have shallow boxes that might be maybe 20, 30 feet long and 6-8 feet wide. And then, of course, would have a series of these depending on how large of operation you have. But they're relatively shallow, maybe a foot, foot and a half deep. And, of course, commercially, what they normally raise the earthworms for, you know, like fishing worms, or now that more and more, because of the high protein content of an earthworm, they're using them for pet foods, cattle feed. Japan purchases tons and tons of earthworms from the United States, and this is probably the biggest way that people make money off of earthworms now, is to grow large quantities of them and send them over to Japan. And this country really hasn't started utilizing them to that extent, but I'm sure in the future we will. Yes? What,
you just put garbage on top of them then, or you have to dig it in?
No, you can put it right on the surface and keep it moist. It's the ideal way is that you should grind your garbage first so that it's a little bit easier for the earthworms to digest, but you don't have to. You can just put regular garbage on top, keep it moist. Like put maybe what they recommend is like an old rug or gunny sacks over the top of it, partially to provide a shade for the earthworms. They need light, but they don't like, you know, very full sunlight, so that if you don't have some cover on it, they'll tend to stay down lower in the, they won't normally come to the top. But they are like the red worm, the red wiggler, which is also called the garbage worm, and they are what they call top feeders, and they will come to the top and eat the garbage right off. Some other methods that they recommend for this is if you have a box, maybe along the side of it, you'd have a trench along the side, and this is where you'd put your garbage, and then allow the worms sort of to come in from the center and just use that as their dining room, because most garbage is more acidic, and earthworms like a fairly neutral climate, neutral soil, and so that you should add lime, a little bit of lime every time you put garbage down, or leaves or grass clippings, whatever, add a little bit of lime, but don't use either agricultural lime or like slack lime. This is too powerful. Use the standard old calcium carbonate, which is very hard to get nowadays because nobody uses it. But you can get it at garden stores, sometimes hardware stores. This soil suite that you can buy in garden stores for adding to the soil, I think is okay to use. At least that's what we're trying to use up here. But a pound of earthworms will eat about a pound of garbage a day under good conditions. And so you can tell again that we're dealing with a large volume of earthworms, like on a commercial basis. In a home situation, you don't put out that much wet garbage, so you wouldn't need that many worms. But like up here, where we might have 300 pounds of garbage, wet garbage a day, 200 to 300 pounds, that we would need that many pounds of worms, and there's between 1,500 and 2,000 worms per pound, so you're dealing with a lot of worms. But the nice thing about it, there's a positive side to it, that earthworms also reproduce very quickly under, again, good conditions. They'll lay, and both, all worms are bisexual, so that they, each worm is a layer of eggs, and they'll lay an egg sac every 10 days and produce maybe 2 to 15 worms out of an egg sac, and they hatch relatively quickly, so that within 3 months you have worms that are adult enough to lay egg sacs again, so that that in a sense, every, you know, every 3 months or so, you're doubling your supply of worms. So once you get into, you know, when you start doubling 10,000 worms, well, then you're getting into big numbers pretty quickly. If you ever want to be a big farmer, I suggest do it in worms, because you can multiply pretty quickly. Yes?
How do they winter in the cold weather?
Well, we've only had them since, we did have them last November, but we kept them in the basement. And this is something you can actually do in your own home with a little bit of experimenting and some information that's available nowadays, is have your own garbage disposal system right in your basement. And then, of course, you don't have to worry about freezing conditions. There's information available where in the Northeast and Maine and that area up there where they have, you know, very extreme winters, that you can, they've also kept worms outside with a cover, like a straw cover on it. Worms will, of course, freeze to death, and they'll also, you know, sense, of course, the cold temperatures and head to the lower grounds if they can get down there to get away from the frost levels. But if you keep some, you know, some cover on them, and of course, if you're in a climate where you have snow is a good insulator. Like up here, where we may have 6 to 10 feet of snow on the ground in the wintertime, if you dig down through that, you'll just hit moist earth. It wouldn't even be frozen underneath. And so that snow is a very good insulator. And so normally, I don't think we'll have a problem with that. We may not be able to dispose of as much garbage in the winter, because we may not want to dig down through 8 foot of snow every time to feed them. But that's one of the things we'll know better next year. But you can keep them in the winter. You do have to protect them. That's definitely something.
Is there one kind of earthworm that's better than
another? Well, from my limited knowledge, the red wiggler which is also known as the garbage worm, is the standard. And they're fairly readily available. The American Bait Farm in California, and if anyone's interested, I can give you the address, is the sort of the national headquarters for vermiculture. That's officially what's called when you raise earthworms. And so if you're embarrassed about talking earthworms when you're having a dinner party, you can tell them that you're in vermiculture, and everybody will be impressed. we got them from California, but a friend of the village that worked up here several years ago was commercially raising earthworms and sent up about 9,000 of them last fall. And so we got ours free from there. But they're not that expensive to get started in. And of course, if you're willing to wait, you know, you can start out very small and wait a couple of years and you've got a big crop, so you don't have to start out with 10,000 right away. So it's sort of a nice thing to get into. Maybe in a year or two, when our population of worms is large enough, then what we'll do in the store, we'll have these little boxes of 100 worms and instructions free of charge, and you can take 100 worms home with you and start your own ecologically sound garbage disposal system. But the main thing I think on a lot of these things is, you know, start to think in your own homes, and even if you have ideas for us here at the village to encourage us to do it, come up with new things that we might try, is to make some positive use of what normally is a negative, you know, a problem. And for everybody, garbage disposal is always a problem, or, you know, most of us don't have to deal with sewage disposal since we don't have much, unless we have septic tanks on our land, and that's not normally true in the cities. So those are what we're doing in that area. One of the most important things with the earthworms is that after they eat the garbage, what they leave behind is what they call castings, which is a very high-quality compost. It's much better than what you could compost normally just through the normal bacterial action. And this material is probably the best substance, like for your house plants or for your gardens, whatever it might be. They do sell worm castings in stores, and now I think the price is coming down a little bit because there's more people getting into it. But you'll see it in garden stores sometimes in very small sacks, and it's very expensive, because there just haven't been that many castings produced, you know, that are commercially available. But it's very excellent for plants. One of the things is, and it's just the miracle of how the earthworm digested it, is that most of the minerals and the chemicals that then are in the castings are all water-soluble, so that they're immediately available to the plant to make use of in the growth structure. And whereas some of the other compost or fertilizers that you might have, some of the minerals are tied up in a non-water soluble way, so that it takes longer for them to, you know, get back into the plant structure. Yes?
How do you separate the castings from the dirt?
Very slowly, very slowly. Now, that's another thing. Commercially, I don't know how they do it. I've never seen it. I'd like to go someplace sometime and see a commercial operation. But it, like what we did when we started it, we used peat moss, and just as an initial starter, and mixed a little bit of dirt, but primarily peat moss. And within a, you know, within a period of time, all of a sudden the brown peat moss is turned all beautiful black, and it has more of a gritty feeling to it, and that's the castings. And what you can do, one method that, that in one book that I read, is you can, you know, on a smaller scale basis, like in a home, you could easily pour out your worms on a sort of a separating table with a larger light above it, 100 watt or 500 watt light bulb, and the worms will get away from the light and will go down to the bottom of the pile, and then you just scrape off the top castings, and you know, then they'll go down again, wait a few minutes, and scrape them off like this. Up here, when we moved them and put them in the present box, we just more or less hand separated the worms out to dump them in the new area bedding. Yeah, and then we sacked up the castings, and we'll use those in our greenhouse when we start the bedding plants next spring, and so we're again hoping to make good use of these. The another thing that we're trying to do here at the village is cut down on our fuel supply. Now, it's very expensive to operate the village. One of the reasons is that at least in the past we've been fairly heavily dependent upon diesel fuel for some building heating, but during the summer primarily heating hot water for like the large kitchen operation, the laundry and so forth in the hospital. During the winter we have to rely on diesel fuel because our own hydroelectric plant doesn't put out sufficient electricity for heating. The water in Copper Creek decreases tremendously. Well, even starting, well, just about all summer long it's decreasing, but there's May 1st we're up to a maximum of water, and then you know, as the summer progresses, the water decreases, but there's such a volume of water there that we don't really notice the decrease until maybe the 1st of September. And then we may have to, at that point, start cutting back on the production of our electricity. Again, there's usually no problem because by the 1st of October, the population in the village is quite low, and we can start closing down buildings. But by the time we get to about the 1st of December, or maybe even 1st of November, then our needs in the village are greater than what we can put out the hydro plant, then we have to turn to wood or oil to provide the heat for the buildings for the rest of the winter. Now what we're trying to do is to come up with methods that we might be able to cut down both of the diesel fuel use and also the use of wood. Even though we're surrounded by literally thousands of acres of trees, a lot of them are not accessible to us because the wilderness starts just a half a mile from the village and we can't cut timber in there. Most of the valley is quite steep and doesn't have roads built up in the mountains, so that that's not accessible to us. So we're really limited in our logging operation, which is very primitive, to about 200 feet on either side of the road. And so you can tell from that even though there are even a lot of trees within that 200 feet, we can't take that many of them because the Forest Service has to mark them. We have to buy them from the Forest Service. And so far, we've only taken either dead or down timber for our sawmill operation and for firewood. We don't cut any green timber at all. And it just so happens that the death rate of the trees, and we're not promoting the death rate, so this is something natural that the Lord has done. And but the trees are dying at about a right rate. We can take out most of the dead or the dying trees as they're occurring along the road. And normally we go down maybe to 6 mile. We have cut some down. In fact, this year we're cutting a few down top of the switchbacks. The firewood situation is such that we are trying to cut down even the use of wood. The oil situation, as you know, the cost is of course increasing. It's one of our non-renewable fuels, which is another reason that we're interested in reducing the consumption. Right now, let's see, in Chelan I think we're paying 98 cents a gallon for diesel fuel, and then it's another 10 cents to get it up to the village. So it's $1.08, $1.09 before we get it here. A year ago, we purchased 42,000 gallons of diesel fuel for our year-round operation, and probably 25,000 to 30,000 gallons of this was used in the winter operation, and the rest was used in the summer operation. This year now, it's really exciting and fun, because I don't think we're going to be purchasing any more than 10 to 12,000 gallons diesel fuel. So we've reduced our consumption by, you know, 30,000 gallons just in the 1 year. Either we're going to be cold this winter, or we hope we didn't miscalculate this. But our tanks are really full already. We have 2 15,000-gallon underground supply tanks for diesel fuel, and they've been full for over a month now, and normally we would be hauling diesel fuel until the 1st of October to fill up everything for the winter. So this is a, you know, a great savings for the village in terms of finances. It's also, I think, exciting from the standpoint that here too, that we can be involved in, you know, often what we're talking about in terms of reducing our consumption of a non-renewable fuel. And the way we've done it so far has been very, very simple, that we've converted a number of our chalets that were previously on oil. We put wood stoves in four of our chalets last year, and we had wood stoves in a couple of others. We've made better utilization of our electricity. A very simple thing in the dining hall that saved quite a bit of money was installing a programmable thermostat that maybe some of you have in your homes. It's just a standard. I think it's put out by Honeywell. Other companies do it, but you can set both the time that you want your furnace on and also a maximum and minimum temperature so that you still can keep your place comfortable, but you're not using your furnace when you're sleeping. And a simple thing like this in your home, I can guarantee you, will save considerable money. When we bought the thermostat 2 years ago, it was, I think, $100. Now, I think that they've actually come down in price now because they're producing more of them. But we probably saved, $500-$600 in the first year by using just this thermostat. So it is well worthwhile to do so. The other thing that we did last year is we insulated some of our chalets a little bit more heavily. We're trying to make better use of plastic on windows, closing down doors that aren't necessary, just like in the dining room itself or in the dining room hotel building. There are, I think, 3,000 doors just in that one building, or at least it seems that way. And most of them, we only need one, I think, in the wintertime, or two. And all the others can be closed off with plastic. And, you know, they're still accessible in case of emergency, but you don't lose all the heat or gain all the cold. And this, even in your own homes, is probably the biggest thing you can do. Even if you don't feel you can afford to insulate, you can go around and make sure that your, you know, the gaps in your doors and places are sealed up around windows. It probably costs more to heat your home because of the cold air coming in through even like wall switches. And you can get little insulating pads you can put in wall switches. And if in extremely cold weather, if you're in a climate like northern Minnesota or any place in the winter, you can put your hand up against a wall switch and feel an awful lot of cold air coming in. And this is where you're probably losing more money and wasting more energy than some of the other things that people talk about. The mammoth insulation project certainly will help, but don't think you have to wait until you can afford to do that in order to save energy and money in your home. There are a lot of little things that you can do. And an excellent source of information now in most communities is your utility districts, you know, like the PUD or the electric companies. They'll provide a lot of information that's very helpful in how you can insulate or where you might be able to buy materials. And most of these things are do-it-yourself projects that you don't have to hire anybody to come in and do. So we know from up here, and we certainly would encourage you to do it in your local situation too. Start on these little things, and then when you see the positive results from these little things, I think you'll be more inclined then to think in terms of, you know, larger projects. And I think the other thing that comes into it in your home situation is that I guess I would encourage you to, you know, not all, only think in terms of cutting down the use of renewable fuels if it's cost effective. And that's, unfortunately, we always tie it to cost effectiveness. And businesses have to do it because they're in the business to make money. And if they don't make money, they can't stay in business. But, and in a way, I guess our homes are the same way. But I think that both businesses and individuals will start having to think in terms of saving energy, even though it might cost us a little bit more initially. the people who save the energy now by putting in some of these, you know, insulation, doing some of these things now, are the ones, I think, that are going to really see the benefit and be thankful they did it in 10 years from now, when it's going to be more expensive to do those things, and they're going to be forced into doing it because the energy isn't there. So, you know, now I think that we really have to think in terms of going ahead with some of these things, even though it might be a little bit more expensive. In terms of like solar, you may, you know, be talking about a 10-year write-off at the present energy rates, and 5 years from now you may be already paid up because of the increase in energy rates, and everybody knows that they're going to go up tremendously, and you know, in these next years there's just no way that it won't. The other thing that we're doing to cut down our energy consumption, well, let me talk about vehicles just briefly, because there's probably more questions on solar than some of the other things. But in our vehicles, of course, we have to drive between the lake and the village, and that's really all that we use except for maintenance. That's where our consumption of gasoline is. We're talking about two possibilities for reducing our need for gasoline in that situation. We're working on, our science committee is working on a proposal right now that will be submitted to the Department of Energy next spring when we're powering some of our vehicles. Now, if any of you, many of you were around in the Second World War, or if some of you have read about it, that Europe literally ran on producer gas. North Africa was the same way. The United States, I don't think, at least from, I don't remember the Second World War that much, and I haven't read that much about it, so I don't think the United States really relied on it much, but Europe did. And basically what it is the production of burnable gas from a solid material, and really about any solid material has some burnable gas in it, like wood, charcoal, even paper. If this method catches on, you can read your Sunday newspaper and then throw it in your producer gas burner in the back of your car and drive down by another paper, and it's sort of perpetual motion. You can, not quite that easy, but any of the solid substances like wood have volatile, you know, burnable gases in them, and they by producing or burning the wood in a specially built heater and then drawing air through this very high temperature up to 900 degrees little furnace that you have mounted on the back of your car or your bus, your truck, then this can be drawn right into your gasoline engine and with minor modifications used to power your engine. There's probably the two reasons it never caught on was that maybe the greatest thing was that during the war it was identified with the lack of gasoline and a war effort, and it was inconvenient, and so that when the war was over, rather than people, you know, keeping their producer gas generators that they had mounted on their cars, they quickly got rid of them because it was identified with the war effort, and everybody wanted to do away with that. It was also the inconvenience, and of course at that time too, the maybe not right after the war, but certainly within a relatively short time, the cost of and the availability of fuel was such that it was cheap enough that nobody wanted to fool around with stoking their car with wood. But you know, we might be back in an era where that's going to be necessary, and it's one of the possibilities because the technology of it is not so great that we at the village here couldn't make use of it, and so that's why we're looking into it. It doesn't take a lot of wood. Just even recently, just a year ago, or maybe it was this year, that in Sweden they've just conducted another project, and paper was written on the conversion of vehicles to producer gas. Sweden was another country that really ran on it during the war days, and so it's still of interest, but you know, all the papers conclude that because of the inconvenience, you do also have a reduction of power in your vehicle by 30-40%, which in most cases probably isn't significant. Now in our situation, we may have to use gasoline engines to come up the switchbacks and then transfer everybody to the buses that would run on producer gas and come the rest of the 8 miles in, but that in itself would save a lot. So maybe when you come back, not next year, maybe 2 years from now, maybe you'll ride up on a bus powered by producer gas.
What kind of maintenance problems do you have with the, I would guess that the spark plugs and engines would probably
Amazingly, I don't know that much about it, but I read a couple papers of it just recently, and that they've had they've had some experiments going, primarily in Sweden, and they had a truck that went, I think, 125,000 miles with producer gas with almost no maintenance. And that I'm not sure why. I would think that the same way that you would, that there would be more impurities getting into the engine and so forth, but I don't know that much about it, but supposedly that it's not that much of a problem, so.
Engines that run on propane, for instance, the contaminants aren't in the oil and so forth.
Right, yeah, that's a lot cleaner with the propane. Now, technically, to operate one of these things is of course, more difficult than just hopping in your car with gasoline. So, you know, there's a shaker on your coals that you have to operate. You know, it's a little bit more complicated, and probably the majority of people, until they automate it, which probably would ruin it, you know, then it won't be practical, except for the do-it-yourselfer, or maybe in our situation where you really have to train somebody to operate a producer gas engine. It's not a matter of turning on the key and you know, stepping on the foot feed. So the other thing that we're looking into, and we have for a couple of years, is the possibility of using hydrogen. I'm sure some of you have read, well, even now, and I think San Francisco, a couple of buses are experimentally running on hydrogen. A fellow by the name of Billings down in Provo, Utah, has been an advocate of hydrogen for a number of years, and first was trying to produce cars. In fact, you could order a car from him that was operated on hydrogen. I don't think he made enough money on that, so he decided to go into real estate, and has, a community down close to Provo, Utah, that supposedly operates all off of hydrogen. The houses are heated by hydrogen, refrigeration is by hydrogen, the cars are operated by hydrogen. And I don't know how far he's gotten with this, but he's a serious advocate of it, yes?
You could use your electricity to generate.
Well, that's it, yeah. We've got the two prime sources of really free sources of energy that we need to produce hydrogen, and that's electricity and water. That by passing an electrical current through water, through electrolysis, that you produce again hydrogen oxygen, and we probably would let the oxygen go and save the hydrogen. But the biggest problem is the storage of the hydrogen, and there are ways that are probably safe and practical, but very expensive. And they call them they have metal hydrides, which absorb hydrogen, certain metals that will absorb hydrogen, and then with the application of a small amount of heat, will release the hydrogen for use. And automobile engines converted over to hydrogen are not complicated or costly. And once the process is started, well, then they bleed off a little bit of the heat from the exhaust system to heat your hydride container, and then this constantly produces your hydrogen. So it's again one thing that you know, could go a long ways to relieve some of our energy problems in the future, but it's such a drastic conversion that it probably will take a long time or may never come about. But on a small scale basis, it could certainly happen, because the process of producing the hydrogen, the technology is there, and you can buy hydrogen generators for, you know, I mean, they're a market item that, you know, for $10,000 you can have one delivered to your home. So it's available, and the technology is there. But because of the cost of storage and maybe some of the complications, that's sort of second on our list. I think the producer gas will be maybe the first thing we'll pursue, and then the hydrogen will be the second, yeah.
Have you looked into methane gas?
Yeah, we have. The problem with methane is that we don't have enough garbage, we don't have enough sewage, and we don't have any cows. And so we don't have enough of anything to produce the methane to really make it practical up here. And but that's certainly another possibility, like if any of you are on farms that, you know, the big feedlots outside of Greeley, Colorado, the Monford lots, where they had, I don't know, 100,000, you know, head of cattle that they feed continuously, they put in a methane generator there, and I think we're, at least theoretically, we're supplying all the gas needs for the whole city of Greeley. And so, you know, it's very practical. The technology, again, is there. Even the technology on a small scale basis in India. In fact, in India, they really pioneered the use of, practical use of methane gas, and are using it a lot. So there's a lot of information for the small scale operator to make use of methane. But it does take, you know, some supply of garbage, sewage, manure, you know, to make the methane. So, The solar energy is the other thing that we've been working with a little bit, and this is a cutaway of one of the panels you probably have noticed on, or if you haven't, take a look at the top of the hospital building. There are 12 panels mounted at that location, and they're now providing some of they're really preheating the water for our laundry operation. That's primarily the water need, the hot water need in the hospital. It's not the residents there or anything else, but it's the laundry that we have for the village. And we originally had planned for those panels to be mounted on the hotel, because we were the hotel was our largest hot water consumer with the large kitchen operation. There we use just in the dishwasher alone, the commercial dishwasher uses 420 gallons of 180 degree water per hour when it's operating. And usually during, like now when we have two settings for every meal, the dishwasher is probably going 5 or 6 hours a day. So we're using maybe 3,000 gallons of 180 degree water, which is an awful lot of energy to heat from the glacier or snow melt water that we have at maybe 38 to 42 degrees. Up to 180 degrees takes a lot of gallons of oil or a lot of kilowatts of electricity. Fortunately, we were able to put in 3 15 kW hot water heaters in the dining hall. And so far, most of the summer, we've been able to operate them 24 hours a day, so that we're not consuming any oil in the hotel this summer. And because of that, we decided to put the solar panels on the hospital, where we are, that's the only building now in the summer that we are consuming oil. And we figure that with the 12 panels, that we're heating about 2 to 3 gallons of water per minute, up to maybe 100 to 120 degrees. And again, like that doesn't sound like much water, but per minute, 3 gallons per minute is 180 gallons an hour, and 5 hours, it's 900 gallons of water. So that's much more than what you would use in a home situation, which would mean that you wouldn't need as many panels. There's a limit to how much water you can put through a panel, per minute or per hour, and still pick up the necessary heat. The sun, fortunately, keeps producing heat and produces about 225 BTUs of energy per square foot on the earth. So when you're standing out there, you're absorbing, depends if you're 1 square foot, or some of us are a little bit smaller, some of you are a little bit bigger than 1 square foot. You're absorbing 225 BTUs per square foot. Everything is absorbing that much, and if we don't use it, it's being re-radiated. The earth gains it during the day, and that's like on a very clear night. There's a lot of re-radiation back to the atmosphere. If there's a cloud cover, there's not as much, so that's why the cool clear nights, or the clear nights are called cool clear nights, because they re-radiate a lot of energy. But so it depends on your square footage of panel. Those happen to be 4x8 panels. They're basically just a wooden frame. We made all of them with here at the village, the wood was even cut with our sawmill. There's fiberglass insulation. Now if you make these, you want to be sure not to use like foam insulation, because these panels if you don't have water going through them, that they can go up to maybe 400 degrees, and like your regular foam insulation will probably disintegrate at maybe 160 to something. We made that mistake up at the River Sauna. Those three panels that we put there when we built those a few years ago, we insulated them with foam, and by the end of the first year the foam was gone and it just melted. It turns back to a vapor at 160 degrees or so, and so you'll want to use something that you're pretty sure it won't disintegrate under high temperatures. And usually this fiberglass insulation is okay. Then just a layer of standard home style aluminum foil, and then the metal collector is the most important the thing that's there. That's really what collects the energy and transfers it to the tubes with the water in it. And we just used a piece of corrugated roofing material. It's steel corrugated galvanized roofing material. And this is probably third on the list of cheap materials that are readily available to use for a collector. If you want to spend the money or buy them commercially, oftentimes you'll buy a copper plate. And of course, that's very expensive, but copper is probably the greatest collect the material you can get. Aluminum is better, but again, more costly than steel. We just use this primarily for the cost factor, and also for the, it's relatively easy to find, although now it's harder to find the corrugated roofing material again, because they're going to like the rib steel and so forth, and they're getting away from using this. So, but you can still find it around. Then we just mounted the copper tubes onto the collector material. It's important to get them as tight against the collector material as possible, because the basics of it is the sun comes in through here and is absorbed by the panel, and then the heat is absorbed by the tubes. And so this material is really the important one, and the good contact between the tubes and the collector. Painted black just to absorb energy a little bit more efficiently. Some studies have indicated that green is more effective than black, but probably not that much difference, so black, green, whatever, don't use yellow or white. And then a couple layers of glazing material. And the idea, again, of a solar collector is much like you've had experience with your car being closed up on a hot day. And if you have your windows rolled up and, you know, in the sun, it can go. I think we had an architect here a couple weeks ago that does a lot of solar work, and they actually instrumented a car, and within 45 minutes it went from 72 degrees up to 120 degrees. And the reason that this happens is that the sun, the light that's radiated from the sun coming down to Earth is at a certain wavelength. It can pass through glass or glazing material like this, but as soon as it's absorbed by the upholstery in your car or by this collector material, it becomes heat, and it's re-radiated at a different wavelength, which then cannot pass through the glass again. And then, in other words, it's kept within here, and that's the idea of the glazing material, that it really traps that heat inside the collector. And then that, of course, increases the efficiency of the collector. That's why when you put up panels, you have to be fairly careful that you don't get tired after you get them on your roof and decide to wait a week before you start running water through them, because it may loosen the joints on the solder, or it may melt the insulation or something else, because they do build up heat very rapidly. And as soon as you get them up, run some water through, even if it's just temporary. And like when we put ours up, we just hooked up a hose and let the water run on the ground for couple days until we finish the plumbing. But you have to keep them cool once you get them hooked up. Also, you want to run enough water through them to keep the collector basically cool, because the maximum heat transfer occurs when there's the maximum difference between the temperature here in the water. As the temperature tends to become closer and closer, like if the water temperature is 90 degrees and your panel is somewhat hotter than that, the transfer of energy is less than if your water in here is like 30 degrees or 40 degrees, and your panel temperature is much higher. So really the highest efficiency from panels occurs when you don't extract a great amount of energy at one time. From what I read, they talk about maybe 30 degrees for each pass that on your panels that you may want to use like a circulating tank, whether it be your hot water heater or some other storage tank, and then set your water flow so that you're circulating water through these panels at a rate where you're not heating it up to 120 degrees with one pass, but maybe you're gaining 40, 50 degrees at once, and then your second pass through you're gaining another 30 degrees, and you finally build up your temperature to where it's up to a usable hot water level. The thing you can do too is, like we do here, we really use it in terms of preheating the water. So that we don't expect to get it up. In fact, you really can't get it up practically up to, like 140 degrees, like we're required to have our laundry water by state health standards. So we still have to use another form of energy, either oil or hopefully in the future electricity, where we can bring the water temperature up from 110 or whatever it would come out of here up to the 140 degree. There's some questions or some, yeah.
You have to just plumb from a cold water source then into your tank and back into the thing just circulating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can use it directly out of these heaters if your volume of water that you need isn't very great. You can use it directly out of the heater, but it's like the garden hose that you have on your lawn for 5 gallons, you'll get very hot water, and then all of a sudden it turns very cold. Well, if you can...
You just have a standard heater?
Well, we have a couple of large storage tanks, but you can use a standard hot water heater, or what they've done now with more solar activity and interest is you can buy hot water heaters that have coils in the base of the heater, so that you can use like an antifreeze solution in your solar panels and circulate this through your hot water heater, and it really preheats your water. And then if you have to bring it up to, you know, again to a higher level, well, then your electric or gas would kick in or oil and heat it up the rest of the way. So that's probably the more practical. Now we're planning on draining our panels, you know, in the winter time because we don't have that much sun, and we didn't want to wait until we could put in a heat exchanger. But depending on where you live, if you live in a freezing climate, you would either have to drain your panels, or if you want to make use of them, use some type of a heat exchanger and an antifreeze solution. Otherwise, you're going to freeze up. Yep.
Have you considered the heat pump approach?
Yeah, we have, but one of the... really like to get one up here, but the problem is the maintenance of the things. And we can usually get by with maintaining our own refrigeration equipment, you know, to keep it going enough, but we don't have the expertise here to, you know, really deal with the heat pump to the extent that I think would be necessary to make it practical. The other thing too is that if you use an air-to-air, you know, conversion of a heat pump, then, you know, you need temperatures at least 40 to 50 degrees for the maximum efficiency, and below that they would kick into another form of heat like electricity anyway, and of course a lot of our weather is below 40 degrees, so we'd have to rely on some other kind of heat source anyway. And the one possibility for a heat pump, and it could be practical in the future, in fact a few years ago we did a little study on reopening the mine, not for mining purposes, but utilizing some of the benefits in a sense from being underground in the mountain. Like when you go deeper into the mine, the temperature stabilizes, and the water that's already in the base of the mountain may be you know, at 60 degrees or 55 degrees. Well, that would be perfect for a water to air conversion of heat pumps, and you could have coils immersed in this water which is stabilized by just the heat of the earth, and then use that to extract and heat buildings here in the village. So there might be some possibility in the future, but now I think technically it's probably not practical.
If you drill 100 feet down, is there
geothermal? I don't know.
Of course, you wouldn't need it if you had it all there.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, would be neat if we had some natural geothermal source of steam. But to go looking for it, of course, is very expensive. And unless we could again get a grant, we certainly are in a location with, you know, being close to Glacier Peak, you know, there's a possibility that we may not be too far from some geothermal, you know, energy, but we could never afford to, you know, drill on our own. So
that is that a bisqueen that
well, this is a special plastic, and you'll have to be careful if you make your own that you don't use just regular window plastic, because it'll deteriorate within a few months because of the ultraviolet light. And even this stuff is the commercial name is Calwall, which they've done a lot in solar energy glazings and materials now, and it's a fiberglass reinforced plastic, and it, in the tests anyway, it's not supposed to be affected by the ultraviolet. But if you use regular plastic, within one summer it'll be gone. So that's one thing you want to be careful of. And of course these materials are, you know, more and more readily available because more and more people are getting into, you know, solar energy. And if any of you are interested in, like, I've got a few addresses for, or one address specifically for catalog on the East Coast, but there are others, you know, in California. Oregon has done a lot in solar energy, more so than even Washington, so. Yes?
I'm from the Seattle Public Library, and I don't know about other cities, but Seattle has a Habitat Collection, the downtown library, and quite a few of the larger branches that includes what they are now the special fund money, buying books on solar energy, alternative forms, and building your energy efficient house or remodeling for energy efficiency. So there are a lot of sources to look at.
Yeah, and this is, I think, one of the fun things about it, again, because so much of it is on a do-it-yourself basis, and solar energy is still in this realm that The commercial panels that you buy will be slightly more efficient, but basically I think that you can do almost as good, you know, on your own, and that's one of the nice things about it, that we're still in that realm of technology with solar energy, that the do-it-yourself or the individual has almost as much advantage as the commercial operation. Sometime in the future, I'm sure there's going to be breakthroughs that will change that, but right now it's ideal for you to do it on your own. And of course, we've just talked about what they call active solar heating. The passive solar heating is probably the best thing to consider, like especially if you're building a new house. Don't build your house unless you consider, passive solar heating. Just the orientation of your home, the amount of insulation in your home, the amount of glass you have on the south-facing side, any heat-absorbing materials, within the home that you can use. And again, there are a lot of available information, like in the libraries, that are great, great reference material. And yes?
Can you speak to the water wheel you have out there and the use of it?
Yeah, the water wheel is primarily an educational model, more so than anything practical. It's a 12-foot wheel. It was, we use the water coming out of the spillway from the existing hydro plant. We do have it hooked up to a small, it's a 7.5 kW generator, AC alternator, but we only would get about 3 kilowatts of power out of it. And we do have it wired into the River Sauna. Right now we don't have it hooked into the River Sauna, but our first thought was that we would power the River Sauna with it, the electric lights and the hot water heater that would supplement the little solar energy down there, and any lights in the paths. And in a sense, that little area down there is almost maybe someday can be our alternate energy park, with the main hydro plant close by, the water wheel, the little pond that's now back to a sauna plunge in the last 3 years has been used for a fish rearing project, and we were growing trout in that pond, and this year we didn't restock it because of some problems. But maybe we can, in the next couple of years, can put up a small wind generator down there. Again, these things wouldn't practically help the energy situation of the village, but they would again be educational models, hopefully, for people that were interested in them. And like, if you're in a situation, if you have some acreage and have a little bit of water available to you, a water wheel can be a practical thing to consider for your own energy needs, because with a 12-foot wheel you could probably produce about 3,000 to 3,500 kilowatts, which, if you're conservative, would be enough for your own home use. And again, the wheel was built right here. It's something that if you're interested in a little carpentry and fooling around, you can do in your own home situation. So there are possibilities that you can look into. And I think in the future, if people continue to buy real estate, that they'll probably be buying it more in terms of solar orientation, or a little stream that might be running through their property for a water wheel or for a hydroelectric plant. Those things will be more important than a view, or if you have a few trees on your land, you might be able to have a producer gas generator on your car and get to town that way. And anything else? Yes?
How big a generator would that water wheel put?
I think about 3,000, 3,500 watts is the maximum that it put out. It's a water wheel looks more impressive than it is. And maybe that's, they've used them traditionally in the past to couple them directly to your work, like a mill or whatever. Yeah, and coupling it directly rather than going through, generator. But of course you can go to a larger than a 12-foot wheel, but it's also a very simple operation, so that even though it won't put out much, it probably won't take much expense to maintain it.
You wouldn't need that much volume of water.
Yeah, you really need quite a bit, because it's really the weight of the water that is providing your power. It's not the flow of the water through. Ideally, the water should go very slow through the flume and just drop into your buckets. The water that's sort of splashing over is wasted water, in a sense. And what you're trying to do, and you get all your power from a water wheel by filling up your buckets efficiently to the maximum, and then the weight of the water from the height where it enters the buckets until where it spills out is where you get your power. The flow of the water has nothing to do with it. Now, on an undershot wheel, it would be different. This is what they call an overshot wheel. An undershot wheel, it would be mounted like in a stream, and actually the water moving through the stream would be powering it. Here, it's just strictly the weight of the water in the buckets. So you want to design it so that the buckets fill up to a maximum very quickly, and then totally empty out at the bottom of your cycle so that you're not lifting water back up, because then you'd be losing power again. So. Yes?
Can you tell us a little bit about the hydro plant?
I'll give you some information, and if I didn't cover it, you can ask some questions. But what we have here is we're operating what they call two impulse turbines, which Pelton was the traditional manufacturer in years past. They're no longer in operation, but they're buckets that are used. That type of impulse turbine is used on where you have a relatively low flow of water but under high pressure. Where you have, like in our situation here, we bring the water down through a 2,900 foot pipe, 14 inches in diameter, but it vertically falls in that 2,900 feet, 634 feet, so that there's, from where it enters the pipe to where it goes into the generators, is 634 feet. And this is really what is significant for the amount of output of your generator. And the stream of water, when it actually hits the buckets, is probably only, you know, 2 inches in diameter. So you're really dealing with a very high pressure, low volume system in an impulse turbine. Each of these units is rated at about 250 kilowatts of electrical output. The impulse turbine would then power the generator, and in our situation, a hydraulic governor controls the speed, because in order to get out 60 cycles, 120 volt power, you have to run, like these particular generators, with the number of poles that they have on the generator, it has to turn at exactly 600 RPM. And so what the governor would do would maintain that 600 RPM. Now, if you brought electric clock along, you'll notice that our power doesn't maintain, or our system doesn't maintain a 60 cycles, because clocks are synchronous motors. And in the cities, they spend a lot of money on generating equipment in order to keep it at 60 cycles. So your electric clock will be accurate.